Welcome to Indie Radio Garden, this week's highlights from community radio in the Philadelphia region.
This program brings ordinary citizens to the air to discuss issues related to health, race, safety, workers' rights, and the will to survive in pandemic times.
The first audio comes from Delaware, WHGE-LP 95.3, where Afro-American Historical Society of Delaware shares Make Some Intelligent Noise show. Rochelle Wilson interviewed Minister John Muhammad, founder of GANG, the Anti-Violence Youth Project, about their mission.
Minister John Muhammad is with me today in the studios here at WHGE, and we are going to have a very in-depth conversation about what's going on. So grab your popcorn and sit back, turn those radios up. Here we go. Let's get started. You're listening to Rochelle Wilson, WHGE, Make Some Intelligent Noise. Thank you so much for being here. We do appreciate you. And for those people in our listening audience that may not have a lot of experience with who you are and how you move and operate, you are a Muslim, and I must say very disciplined. You and I have had brief interactions before, but we never really got together and had a good conversation. And so I'm so happy to have you here today so we can do that. But tell us a little bit about, what does it mean to be a Muslim man? What is that?
Well, first of all, let me start in the name of Almighty God, beneficent, the merciful. I bear witness that regardless the land, label, or language, there is but one God. So I'm honored to be here with you as a student and a follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. At this great black-owned, as you said, black news station, I'm honored to be with you right now, Sister Rochelle, because we'll remember this. I'll be able to tell my grandchildren. Well, as you blow up, as you said, I'll be able to say I was there in the early days.
In the early days.
So I want to say assalamu alaikum to the Muslim family. Praise the Lord to my Christian family. What's up to the hood and peace to the God.
Yes, I love it.
And your, as far as your question, I am a proud member here of Muhammad's Mosque, number 35. Here in Wilmington, Delaware, our great minister, student minister, Robert Muhammad. He's been our resident minister here for the last 20 years, and I'm honored to serve him and work with him and head the youth ministry of the mosque here. So that's what I do. I work with the youth. That's my passion. Coming from Jersey to Delaware, working with our youth, it's an eye-opener. It's humbling, but it's rewarding at the same time. Yes. So being a Muslim in a world like this, you may be shocked with this language, but it's like following Christ. For he said in this world, you know, to follow him, you got to pick up your cross. And in a world that's going to hell, striving to be right in a world like this, there's a cross to bear.
Oh, yes.
But you got to pick it up, yeah. And you got to follow him. And so those of us who join the Nation of Islam, we understand that. We get an X when we join. So we keep the first name out of respect for our parents. So we're given the X. So it's like being in a dojo. When you first go to the dojo, you don't give yourself a black belt. You start with a white belt, and you work your way up. So Brother Malcolm started as Malcolm X. But his teacher saw him and gave him the name Malik Shabazz. Cassius X, he started out Cassius X Clay. But his teacher watched him and gave him the name Muhammad Ali. Minister Farrakhan started out as Louis X. But his teacher watched him and gave him the name Farrakhan. So I came in the nation, I was John X. And as we grew and helped the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan pull off the historic Million Man March with over 10 million men gathered in D.C. Our reward for helping him is young men and women in our nation, we were given the name Muhammad. So it's a name to look up to. It means one worthy of praise and one praised much. That is God. We are just striving to live up to that name. So being a Muslim in a world like this, a striving, practicing Muslim, you have a cross to bear. There's so many distractions. But the key is to stay busy in the resurrection of the dead. And that's your protection. Staying busy. And that's what I try to do.
You are absolutely amazing. And I just want to say for my Christian listeners out there, do not be shocked to hear a Muslim speak of Christ. It is their obligation. It is a part of their religion. You must study the Bible as well as the Quran. You must know to show thyself to be approved. Absolutely. And so I honor you for that. I've met Muslims that know the Bible better than some Christians. So I respect that. But you work with young people at the masjid, and that is your passion, and maybe that's our connection, that we both love young people, but you love it so much that you have started an organization in an attempt to help them.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about your organization and give us the why. People want to know why we do things.
Well, shout out to my brother who was the minister in Trenton, New Jersey. His name is Manatee. He's now in Willingboro right now. When I was in New Jersey as the student minister in a little city called Asbury Park, a little short town, little city with a big heart, in the early 2000s, New Jersey and a little bit of Philly was hit with the onslaught of the gang violence. As you all know, some of you know the history, the Bloods and Crips, they're on the East Coast now, and it's all good. But when it hit like a wildfire. And our young men, they were so young. You know, we are used to dealing with, okay, if there's a beef, you know, you go to the elders and you deal with it. But at that time, the elders were 18. Like, your big homie is 19. Like, you're still living with your mother. So it was tough. But our Bloods and Crips, you know, they worked it out. It was a lot of death. It was a lot of shooting. So my brother and Manatee, you know, we would work together because sometimes the shot callers wasn't in my city. It was in Trenton. Mm-hmm. It was in Newark. Mm-hmm. It was in East Orange. So as we started to learn, we said, man, we got to figure out a way to come at our youth in a way that they can understand. Mm-hmm. So we came up with a language called GANG, and it stands for Going After the Next Generation.
Oh, nice.
And it initially started to deal with our brothers who were besieged with the Bloods and the Crypt and the negative way it was coming. And so we used that to get into the schools, and it has been refined over the years by the grace of God. We're now in Ferris now. We're going back to Ferris now that COVID is allowing us back in. But GANG is generally going after our young people with a teaching that is rooted in Black power.
All right.
And Black consciousness. We don't apologize for that. We know what our young people need. We know that there's certain things that we can only give them as a man growing up in America. So we are universal because when I'm in the prisons, it's white, Black, Chinese. I don't deny them. The word is the word. But we primarily go after our young people, and we go after them with conflict resolution, which is number one. Of course, bullying, peer pressure, the respect for the female is one of my biggest workshops because that's a big one.
Oh, yeah.
Now, what to do when stopped by the police? Our young brothers, they're warriors, but they just don't have the knowledge. So the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan wants us to give them the knowledge because knowledge is power. Mm-hmm. And if you look at our soldiers in the streets of Philly, Delaware, Wilmington, Jersey, they're warriors, but without guidance. When you're a soldier or warrior without guidance, nothing good comes out of that. You'll turn on each other.
So you and I may very well agree based on the original times. Our young men at a certain age had to go through a rites of passage, and I believe it was kill a lion or something of that nature, or whatever they had to show themselves to be approved. And so they did this at, what, 14, 15 years old? Their fathers or whoever in the village would take them out, you hunt and you do these things. And it was a rites of passage. But now in the city, the young warriors don't have a lion to kill. So they're killing each other. At last report from mainstream media, which I give only 50% credence to in telling the truth, but mainstream media is telling us 367 youth-related violence death has occurred in Philadelphia alone. And Philadelphia is only 30 minutes away from here, right? So, you know, we've got young people, young warriors here in Wilmington that are going in. We need to find some lions and let them loose on the street.
Well, you know, that's another conversation, Queen, because the lions are here. But we have a system that is scared of the lion. So that's another conversation we got to have, Queen, because there are those who can reach out to you, but because of the labels you put on the lion, we're anti-white, we're anti-Semitic, we're blah, blah, blah. So now you put us in a cage where we can't reach our young people because the very lions who can reach them, you've already labeled us as hating you. So in Delaware and Philly, there are those who can help your youth. Will you be strong enough to say, Brother John, come after my young people? I don't care what they say about Farrakhan. I don't care what they say about Dr. Umar Johnson. I don't care. You brothers have something that our young people need. Would you do that, Black Delaware? Or will you stay a coward and distance yourself from Minister Farrakhan and the conscious community like we got COVID and sentence our young men to death because you won't let the lion near your son?
Wow, that is powerful. And I know it's another conversation, but I do want you to expound on it. But let me preface by saying this. I honor Minister Louis Farrakhan because of his teaching and his wisdom. And when you see that the government, and we won't put a color on it, but we see the government wants to assassinate him. Whatever he speaks, he has to be protected by shields because we know that there are people who would destroy him because he can bring 10 million men together to stand on the steps of the White House.
Four times.
I was at one with my son Justin was 10 years old for the first one, October 16th.
1995.
Yes.
Then we had the Million Family March in 2000.
I was there.
Then we had the Millions More Movement 2015.
Missed that. Million Woman March.
1997 in Philly.
Yes, yes.
And then we just had 10-10-15 in 2015. So here's a man that brought millions of our people together.
Yes.
No violence.
Nothing.
We didn't storm the Capitol.
Nope.
We didn't take over Nancy Pelosi's chamber. Kept them all clean.
Yes, yes.
But we are demonized.
Yes.
So because we are demonized, these nonprofit organizations in Delaware and Philly and Jersey who get your money from your slave master, now you are scared to let us in to talk to our youth who use your mission statement say you want to serve them, but you won't let the lions in.
Expound on that.
So you got brothers and sisters saying black power, but how can it be black power coming from a white source? How much power can you have when your former slave master is giving you your money? So you talk black until we show up. See, we're the litmus test. You pro-black till the brothers show up.
The second audio comes from WGGTLP 92.9 G-Town Radio from the show Germantown Info Hub. Malika Froyan interviews Margaret Robertson from the Germantown Participatory Defense Hub about participatory defense and how these work.
What is participatory defense and how does it work? It uses family and community organizing to work with folks who have been arrested to support them and get better outcomes from the court system. Margaret Robertson, who works with the Germantown Participatory Defense Hub, is here today to tell us more. Thank you so much for joining us, Margaret.
Thank you.
Participatory defense. It supports people in a variety of ways after they've been arrested. What are some of those ways?
The three main parts of participatory defense are, first, information, telling you what is going to happen and what you can do at each step in the process. The second part is helping you present yourself, because normally the only thing that's presented in a criminal case is your history, your criminal history. So we help you to tell the attorneys, including your own, and the court, other things about you, about your family, about your work history, about your education, about the things you've done in the community, about any health problems or perhaps even addiction problems you might have, and how you are trying to address those problems, about your future hopes, and who supports you in the community. Mm-hmm. Because all of these influence the outcome of whatever happens in your case. And finally, we go to court with you. That is dependent upon what's going on in the courtroom, because some judges will let you in. Some judges are still reluctant. Some judges will let as many people as you want, and others may limit the numbers who can come in. And it depends too, because some people are in family court where things are a lot different, or in a criminal court where things are much more open.
Mm. So the participatory defense team, they'll follow you all the way to the sentencing of the actual trial or the court system.
Yes.
And why is it important, that social biography that you were talking about, what you are in the community, things that you do, health problems, things like that? Why is that important for people to know, especially your attorneys?
Well, it can make the difference between actually the type of representation you get.
Mm.
Because if you are seen as just a list of encounters with the law versus a whole person who matters to some people, you can mm-hmm. be treated very differently. I've seen amazing things happen. I'm not saying that every case is dismissed or everyone's acquitted, but even if you are convicted, the type of sentence you get can really be influenced by who is supporting you.
That's good to know. And the other thing that I noticed, you had given me some background information about the hubs. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that they said that they're agents of change and not really service providers or not mm-hmm. service recipients. Can you tell us more about that? What does that mean?
Well, you lead. If you mm-hmm. don't really want our involvement, or if you want limited involvement, nobody is going to come to your house and pull you out the door or insist that you get on a Zoom. It's really how much you want our involvement in your case. And if you're incarcerated, it's going to be led by your family. So we help, or we involve ourselves to the extent you want us involved.
Margaret, is it possible for you to step us through some of the services? Give us an example of a person that has been arrested and uses participatory defense to help them. Say a family member's been arrested.
Okay. My favorite one, I think, is a starting point, because many people don't understand. I mean, I've even heard of people who've been arrested and then they've been released and they still don't know what happened to them because the whole thing is so much of an overload, a sensory overload. First of all, you are not in court. You're on a video. So the bail commissioners are at 13th and Filbert in the Criminal Justice Center, and you're probably in a police station. And you may be there for many hours, maybe 12 hours, maybe even longer. And then you appear on a screen. There is a defender there from the Public Defender's Office, or the Defender Association is the proper name, and then an assistant district attorney. And the bail commissioner, who is not necessarily a judge, is not elected, has been appointed by judges. You are in a different, you know, you're not in the same place. You can't speak to the defender. It's basically you're asked to answer questions. The amount of interaction is very limited because everything you say can be held against you.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a question, you can't ask the defender, should I say this or that? You know, it's just very remote.
Right.
And I think my personal feeling, and others also, is that it's easier to make decisions that are harsh when the person's not in the room. After that's over, let's say you are released on your own recognizance. That means you don't have to do anything. You can just go and they expect you to come back for the next hearing. Or you might get sign on bail, which means you don't have to pay unless you don't show up. Or you might get an actual bail amount. One of the things that happens is that people don't always understand that you need to, you will either have an attorney assigned or you have to get your own. But they don't necessarily understand that you immediately need to contact that attorney. If your preliminary hearing is in several weeks, you don't show up in court on the day of the hearing and expect your attorney to do the best job, because you need to have explained the case, told your side, possibly found witnesses and given your attorney the names of those people. Maybe there's some video. You need to secure the video before it's taped over. Just so many things you can do to help your attorney at that first stage. A lot of people have gotten upset because the attorney doesn't say anything positive about you. Mainly that is just fact-finding to find out the charges against you. And if the attorney knows what questions to ask, that can be very helpful in feeling out the witnesses. But some people are really angry and upset because you didn't say anything on my behalf. Well, that's not the purpose of the preliminary hearing. That can get the attorney-client relationship off on a bad start. Just because.
Is this where participatory defense can come in? And
right. We could explain to you. If you contact us early in the process, we'll explain what's going to happen and help you help your attorney.
And I heard that a lot of the participatory defense volunteers have actually used the services themselves and then become volunteers to help other people.
Yes, and especially in the older hubs. In some other, not in every case, but sometimes they've been on the other end. They've been the defendants. They've even served time. And they know whereof they speak.
So they actually could see where there's parts of this process that are confusing, that might need, you know, just more guidance and more help from some of the volunteers that you work with.
Absolutely. The people who have lived experience are really valuable.
Okay, so we're at the preliminary hearing. What comes next after that?
After that, we have a chart, which I don't have in front of me, that tells you all the steps. At that point, the main thing you do is stay in touch with your attorney. You support your attorney in planning, and you will be given a hearing that will just tell you what's coming next and at the court. There are about 8 steps, and each one is, some require your attendance, others don't. Each one is really important that you show up, unless your attorney tells you not to, because one of the things that are really negative in the process is failures to appear. And sometimes it's really innocent, especially recently, because there were a lot of changes on dates and people were not always contacted, but that still can count against you.
So, and I'm also assuming that COVID-19 also made this process even more difficult.
Yes, because the courts shut down for a long time. It's been really, really backed up. So there are people who've been held for much longer than anybody expected to be held.
Margaret, what made you get into this work?
I had a family member who was arrested. And I didn't know up from down. I didn't know anything. And 6 years in, I heard about participatory defense. It was at that time, it started in Norristown. Our former defender, Kira Bradford Gray, was working in Montgomery County, and she brought it to Montgomery County. She started it up in 2015, and then she left to come to Philly to work as the chief defender here. She brought participatory defense with her 3 years later in 2018. And when I heard about it in 2015, I was just thrilled because I knew how I had felt. I didn't know anything. I didn't know what to expect. I remember asking the attorney who's representing my relative, what comes next, you know, when my relative was convicted. And the attorney looked at me like, I never heard that question before. I didn't know anything. I know how it felt, and I didn't want anybody else to go through that.
So you started getting into this work and this organizing so that other people wouldn't have to go through what you went through, not knowing the different things. Is there a time that you can think of that the Participatory Defense Hub helped someone in the court system and maybe shifted it to a better outcome? I'm sure you have a few tales.
Yeah, Yeah, but I guess one of my favorite ones is a gentleman who had come into some money, but because of a death of a relative, so that's not the best way to get money, mm-hmm. and spend it on drugs. And that he had stopped, but because of the stress of the and emotion of this loss, he purchased drugs, and the amount he purchased was so significant because he had money to do it that he was arrested and charged with distribution and thought he was trying to sell it. A lot of people came to his aid. I don't know. I think he had over 20 people in the courtroom, a combination of family and people from the hub, different hubs, several hubs. The judge just gave him house arrest. Mm-hmm. It was crazy. And he had been expecting to get several years in state prison. And one of the things that influenced was the fact that he had not been using and he had been caring for children, his children. And one of the concerns was, now what's going to happen to them? The social bio.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It showed the court his whole humanity.
Right. And the fact that this was not regular, this was the response, his response to the death of someone really close to him. It wasn't the best response, but it was something that people do.
That is a story that I can really visualize that. And I appreciate you telling us about that. I want to thank you so much for being with us tonight, Margaret. How can people learn more about the Germantown Participatory Defense Hub?
The number is 267-277-3117. And we are one of seven. So there are other hubs throughout the city. One hub specifically works with young people. I'd say anybody under the mid-20s and under. And if you wanted to get information about that, the list is on the Defenders Association website. And that's philadefender.org.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us. My name is Gabriella Daza. I'm an intern at Scrap Prometheus Radio Project. Indie Radio Garden is a Prometheus Radio Project production.